So I actually wrote for today's lecture an introduction that I've decided somewhat at the last minute to forego in the interest of time so that I have more time to read slowly and to leave, I hope, some time for discussion. Let me just sort of summarize what that introduction was meant to do. I think it would have been superfluous for most of you. I am going to be speaking this afternoon, as you'll know if you've looked at the readings, almost entirely about questions of sound, which is where some of my work, much of my work, has been in the past several years. But simultaneous with that work, and in many ways overlapping with it, I've been trying to grapple with the question of classical reception, classical reception and its methods. That became a process of sort of interrogation, including self-interrogation, with a special sense of purpose after I moved to the United Kingdom, which is one place where classical reception is pursued with great vigor, less so in the United States. I've left there 3 years ago, and I nevertheless have continued to try to formulate my thoughts about reception. So I'm just going to tell you what I'm sure all of you know. Reception is itself an intervention in what used to be called the study of the classical tradition. Both differ in the way and in which they locate the primary object of meaning and value. The classical tradition imagines that value and meaning begin with those glorious Greeks and Romans who generously bestow on the rest of Western history their treasures. Classical reception shifts the focus to what Charles Martindale, in Redeeming the Text of 1993, calls famously the point of reception, allowing later readers of the classics to act creatively with that tradition, in fact, really to create it whole cloth, tabula rasa, for themselves. Now, many people have been dissatisfied, for all that reception has been a salutary intervention, have been dissatisfied with it as the only alternative and have sensed that something in the process went missing. And so my work has been about trying to think about what interests me most, which is the idea of the tradition as an ensemble, as an assemblage, as a thing that does something as a network, as a system. And one of my interventions then into the traditions of studying classical reception under that banner was something that I called Deep Classics, which is a volume that Victoria didn't mention, is the only one I think she didn't mention, but it's definitely my most important book because it has by far the most beautiful cover. So if you buy just one, buy that one. But Deep Classics was meant to inflect the notion of deep time, which is something that comes to us out of the history of science. Deep time is the putative meditation on a putatively new object in the 17th, really 18th century by early modern science, beginning to contemplate things like evolutionary time, geological time, cosmological time. And I've given you as number zero, since I'm not going to be talking about it, even though that's exactly what I'm doing, as number zero on your handout, the most famous passage of a deep time encounter. This is John Playfair describing in 1788 the encounter of James Hutton. I think it says John on your handout. James Hutton, sorry about that, at Sycar Point on the Scottish coast. And what, you know, in a sort of nutshell, Deep Classics tries to argue is that classics, long before these 18th century encounters, classics provided an object, provided time as an object itself. To think about time, if you stop and think about it for a moment, it's impossible to think about time. The moment you create time as an object of thought, you have taken time out of time, because an object has to be there before you all at once. So your thinking about time is often the thinking about time through a proxy for time. A timeline, a history, a process, those are all things that we imagine at once, right? Synoptically. And by that very synopsis, we strip them of their temporal element, right? And so I'm very interested in the ways in which we substitute these kinds of objects, these kinds of simultaneously present objects, for time itself. And that's what Hutton is doing, looking at the stack layers of rock on the Scottish coast. He can see all of geological history all at once. It's all still there now, right? Which, of course, is a kind of oxymoron. And classics has long done the same thing. If you stand on the Campidoglio and look down at the Forum, you're contemplating time because all of that time is right there under you, right? So what I'm going to be saying today is related to that project of deep classics, but it moves in another direction. It moves toward what I have been also doing, including in relation to the history of sexuality, that is thinking about classics and the classical tradition as a kind of synoptic, synthetic network that enables the piecing together in sort of non-prioritized ways of things that have happened over history but cannot be located very securely in history. So having said all of that, that was my introduction. Probably having read it would have been shorter. I'm going to jump right into the main event. In 1617, the Jesuit Fabiano Strada published in Rome his Prolusiones Academicae, comprising in a single volume divided into three short books the texts of several public lectures, usually from the start of an academic year or course, hence prolusions, delivered in his capacity as professor of Latin eloquence at the Collegio Romano. And his title page is a large image on the back of one of those handouts. Strada's style is elegant, his anecdotes entertaining, and he seems to have designed each lecture to highlight his own performative gifts, including what must have been a sense of comic timing refined over years in the classroom. His subject matter is usually serious enough in broad terms, but often funny in the fine print. The final lecture, on the custom of wishing good health to people who sneeze, plays for academic laughs from the get-go, opening with the story of a baker from the outskirts of Rome who sneezed 23 times in a row, and then once more, at which point he dropped dead. Add death by sneezing, Strada wryly suggests, to humanity's list of things to worry about. About the relative merits of the collected lectures, it is easy to agree with J.E. Sandys, who in his equally readable History of Classical Scholarship singles out the second book's fifth and sixth prolusions, which comprise a single lecture in two parts, titled Academia, as the most interesting of the lot. More recently, Gerard Passanante has found in the Academia of Strada, who had, he aptly notes, quote, a talent for metaphor and a decidedly Baroque sensibility, unquote, an engaging way to launch his brilliant 2011 study, The Lucretian Renaissance. Taking poetic style as the subject matter of these paired prelusions, Strada proposes to relate a story told to him a few months before by Alessandro Borghi, subsequently deceased, who in turn had heard the story in his youth from the aged poet Gerolamo Amalteo. Amalteo could tell a story in a way that, as we say, made the past come to life. Or to put this more as Borghi did, according to Strada, Amalteo made his listener feel present in the past, ut sibi videatur superiori saeculo inter fuisse. The past in question lay about 100 years before Strada and his audience, in the pontificate of Leo X, born Giovanni de' Medici, son of Lorenzo the Magnificent, and product of some of the most glorious years of Florentine humanism. Angelo Poliziano himself had been the future pope's childhood tutor. The distinguished scholars and writers of the period moved through Leo's court, and with them came long festering controversies about the relative merits of the poets of ancient Rome. Never mind the hour's other controversies stirred up by a faraway German named Martin Luther. The factions had become so entrenched, Strada relates, that gentlemen of fashion went about in Leo's day identifying themselves as Lucretians or Virgilians, or Ovidians, or Stations, or as the adherents to some other famous poet's implied poetic creed. At the nerve center of the conflict was the Academy of Strada's title, an informal group of extraordinarily important thinkers who met occasionally to drink and trade insults, with the Pope himself sometimes in attendance. Whether Strada's tale has some basis in fact is not really our concern, though much or all of what comes next is clearly of his own brilliant making. And I feel I need to underscore this. I can't continue reminding you that this is all fake news, right? But this is fiction. Strada has invented, almost certainly entirely on his own, just about everything that I'm going to say. Exasperated by their inability to settle their differences, the members of the Academy appeal to Jacopo Saruleto, the least partisan member of their circle, quim unice habebant in quo nulla factione signa deprehenderant. The Academy, Saruleto reports, regarded itself as a senate, and Saruleto was then its princeps. Saruleto is best remembered today as the author of a short Latin poem on the momentous rediscovery and excavation of the Laocoon in Rome in 1506, written soon after the fact and widely disseminated. Sandys summarizes, quote, "In the enthusiasm kindled by the recent discovery of the masterpiece, the poem was warmly welcomed. Bembo read it 100 times, but it is to be feared that, to many modern readers, it will seem as polished and as cold as the marble which it commemorates," unquote. John Addington Symonds, in The Revival of Learning of 1877, the second volume of his Renaissance in Italy, had already called the verses frigid and labored, comparing them to a prize exercise of the sort well known to a Victorian educated at Harrow and Oxford. But the poem has received a critical reevaluation in recent decades, including close reading and translation by Michael Baxendall. It also gets a mention in Leonard Barkin's meditation on the Laocoon's rediscovery at the beginning of his Unearthing the Past. Certainly, as Sandys acknowledges, the poem found enthusiastic admirers among Saruleto's contemporaries. Barkin quotes a 1506 letter of Cesare Trivulzio, who notes that the poet, quote, "has described Laocoon and his sons no less elegantly with his pen than the very makers of the work realized him with their chisel. In the end, those who read Saruleto's verses won't have all that much need to see the statue itself, so well does he place every detail before your eyes," unquote. 2.5 centuries later, Lessing would reproduce the entire poem as an appendix to his celebrated work, Laocoon, first published in 1766. Were it not for the fame of the statue and of its eponymous central figure, the poem's beginning might be mistaken for the start of a horror story. And it's on your handout. "Ec alto terrete cumulet ingentesque ruinae visceribus iterum reducem longinque retexit Laocoonta dies," and so on. "Behold, from a high mound of earth, from the bowels of a massive ruin, a faraway day uncovers Laocoon home again." Roused from his perennial sleep, though still tangled in a sculpted serpent, itself trapped in the moment of sinking venomous fangs into heroic flesh, Laocoon, quote, "redeemed from the shadows, now looks again upon the lofty walls of Rome reborn. Nunc celsa revisit exemptum tenebris reduivae monia Romae." Lessing famously makes the statue emblematic of the workings of space and time in visual art, citing Saruleto's poem in full as part of a strategic counterfactual argument. Had Virgil's famous description of the scene of Laocoon's demise been based on the statue, he would have written something more like what Saruleto did. But for Saruleto and his contemporaries, the Laocoon was talismanic of space-time mysteries, slightly different from those that captivated Lessing. Where and when does this strange visitor from the past find himself? Of space and time, he is a kind of bastard child, a filius terrae, son of the soil, to borrow a colorful phrase of classical Latin rescued from analogous obscurity a generation before by Leo's teacher Poliziano. Or rather, he is a kind of zombie, emerging from the dirt into a city that is itself described as a resurrected corpse, Roma Rediviva, Rome alive again. The undead present is briefly seen from the perspective of a living past, which the poem addresses from afar, that is, from a vantage point of a longinqua dies, a distant day, which stands by metonymy for the ever-lengthening line of time between. What does damaging time, dies, not diminish, asks Horace. Dam nosa quid non eminuit dies. But in the Laocoon's case, not only has time finally uncovered what it had covered, but the passage of time has actually made the statue even more of a marvel in the Rome of now than it was in the Rome of then. Indeed, the past suddenly has been made so miraculously present that Sadoleto can next apostrophize a Roman emperor in order to identify this sculpted Laocoon as the very one, quote, who once stood in a royal palace and decorated your home, Titus, unquote. In like fashion, the artists of Renaissance Rome greeted the statue's makers, three Rhodians, according to Pliny the Elder, as contemporaries, not so much because their predecessors had traveled forward with the work, as because they themselves, via the work, traveled back, in effect becoming ancient sculptors in order to repair damage to, for example, the central figure's right arm, which damaging time had in fact diminished. Michelangelo himself was present as the statue emerged from the earth, and he alone seems correctly to have surmised that his ancient counterparts would have bent that missing forearm backward, rather than stretching it upward, the latter being the favored restoration until the actual missing piece was rediscovered at the beginning of the 20th century. For minds like his, the statue was an invitation not just to imitation, but to intuition, leading to a kind of intimacy with the past that closed all distance into a lover's embrace. From Sadoleto's eyewitness report from the dreamscapes of early Cinquecento Rome, let us return to the slightly less reverent remembrances of Sadoleto by Strada a century later. Sadoleto accepts the petition of the academicians, but proposes that, instead of settling the matter privately, he should preside over a public contest in which each lauded ancient poet would be represented by a champion who would present a new composition of his own in the particular style of his favored predecessor. The audience, rather than Sadoleto himself, would acclaim the eventual winner. To make things even livelier, Sadoleto proposes that each champion come costumed as his poet. The parties agree, and no sooner does word of the plan begin to spread than the curious, already free for carnival, begin to clog the streets leading to the selected venue, the House of Alejandro, presumably Gerolamo Alejandro, a cardinal, lexicographer, and poet, who surely would have been counted among the Academy's members. And once again, this is all Strada's fiction. The champions begin to arrive one by one. Giovanni Pontano, dressed as Statius, wearing a laurel crown and golden chain granted to that poet by Domitian, first rides in on a tall, loudly trotting horse. He is followed by Baldassare Castiglione as Claudian and Ercole Strozzi as Ovid, likewise mounted and appropriately accoutred. Pietro Bembo as Lucretius follows on foot, as befits one impersonating a poet who was also a philosopher. His heavy philosopher's cloak, worn over a Roman toga, slows him down a bit, but as he makes his way, he declaims the manifesto Lucretius himself repeats twice in his poem, I wander through terrain untrod by the muses, etc. Giovan Paolo Parisio comes next as Lucan, who attempts some fancy horsemanship on, unfortunately, a tired and uncooperative horse, with disappointing results. But the crowd's eyes are at once distracted by the last, but not least, of the lineup, Andrea Navagero as Virgil, drawn in a four-horse chariot, dressed in purple and waving his poet's supposedly eponymous wand, or wirga. After welcoming them all, Sadoleto proposes an analogy for the contest's subject matter, clearly inspired by the remarkable sfilata di moda that has just occurred. Quote, as I prepare to unfold, like an article of clothing, the question of poetic style, dictio, an image springs conveniently to mind of a large and wealthy household's wardrobe, in which some clothes are for travel or exercise, some are for use at home or in the city, some are costumes only suitable for public spectacles. And just as these do not all serve the same purpose, so too do they not share an identical form. That's number two on your handout. The key, Sadoleto continues, even at the risk of explaining the obvious, is to know what to wear when. Then comes the analogy's hinge. Words are like a kind of clothing for meaning, verba quodam sunt veluti rerum indumentum. He is, in this mining, a very ancient vein of thought, by which the question of style is resolved into a question of suitability to subject matter. Indeed, in the expansion that follows, one easily hears the classroom bullet points of Professor Strada, teaching tried and true approaches to eloquence, even while setting the stage for a slightly subtler pedagogical game by which, in the end, everyone present can be declared a winner, each in his own particular way. But before the contest can begin, Camillo Cuerno, who had himself called Archipoeta, and who, according to legend, fled his native Puglia for Rome, lyre in hand, when he heard of the favor shown to Leo by Leo to poets, makes a surprise appearance, disrupting the proceedings. This in turn sets in motion a series of events that leads to the contest postponement to the second of Strada's paired prelusions, evidently given a year after the first. In the interim, Strada decided to move his story to the more spectacular setting of the Villa Manliana, i.e. the Castello della Magliana, a papal property down the Tiber from Rome, almost to the sea, which Leo, with the help of Bramante and Michelangelo, had transformed into a sumptuous gathering place for the artists, writers, and scholars of his court. There, Strada tells his returning audience, the river's banks were packed with spectators who had heard, among other things, a rumor that the Pope himself may join the contest. We're about halfway through this story, but trust me, it gets better as we go forward. Down the canal comes a giant fake floating rock, propelled by six water wheels, themselves powered via complex gearworks by several horses hidden in the contraption's belly. Already at first glance, Strada explains, anyone could recognize the rock as Mount Parnassus. Among other details, the Pegasus perched at the top, kicking open the spring of Hippocrene, was a dead giveaway. Further, the fact that of the nine muses, only Calliope was present made it clear that what was represented was specifically that part of Parnassus reserved for epic poets. Indeed, the learned spectator, who was also a careful listener, could already detect something like hexameters in the six water wheels that were the feet that kept the whole thing moving. And the cleverest members of the crowd eagerly shared with their neighbors an interpretation of the floating Parnassus as a lavish figure for the unstable nature of poetry itself. All the contestants are aboard, having been allowed to choose whatever spot on its slopes they thought most suitable. Pontano Eustatius climbs the higher half of the mountain's famous double summit. Perched on a crag, he attracts everyone's curious stare, quote, like a tightrope walker courting danger, unquote. Castiglione's Claudian takes the other, lower, plainer point. Bimbo's Lucretius predictably is intent on understanding how the machinery works, and so gets lost in the bushes at the mountain's base. Strozzi's Ovid can't settle on a spot, and so keeps changing, a symptom not so much of his metamorphic themes as of his poetic dexterity, though he never tries to climb very high. Parisio's Lucan boldly mounts the statue of Pegasus, but struggles not to slide off, prompting general shouts of alarm. Navagero's Virgil, in another play on the latter's name, cozies up to the virgin Calliope in a shady grove of laurels. As the float approaches the villa, it is met by a small boat piloted by Cuerno, perched on a dolphin and dressed like Bacchus, who greets its passengers in verses improvised to the sound of his own boat's rhythmical rowing. All disembark and make their way to the palace's great hall, filled with members of the papal court. Leo himself watches, albeit from a dignified hiding place, having decided in the end not to compete, but not wanting to miss the party entirely. Then, finally, the planned poetic recitations begin. Each consists of a few dozen lines quoted in full by Strada, who of course is the real author of them all. He follows each with a quick summary of the critical assessment of the listeners. But when all is said and done, the crowd equivocates long enough to be interrupted by a trumpet blast declaring a papal military victory. No one is declared a winner, but neither is anyone called a loser, and everyone goes home having had a riotously good time, including, of course, Strada's audience, which has waited a year for the lecture's over-the-top grand finale. I want to use Strada's slapstick lecture to ask what I think is a rather serious question about the temporality of haunting. To be sure, Strada's conjured humanists more resemble characters in a film by the Marx brothers than they do Derrida's Spectres of Marx, the essay in which he coined the term hauntology, with an eye to how the past sometimes floats through time unmoored. Nevertheless, let's rewind to the verses that really are the lecture's tour de force demonstration of Strada's formidable talent. For here, I would like to suggest, amid all the fun and frivolity, we find nothing less than a genuine wrinkle in time. Here's a quick summary of the performances, and it's here that your second handout may prove especially useful. Sort of list of names. Parisio as Lucan goes first, with a tale of Alfonso X of Castile, who fought a civil war against his own son. Next comes Bembo, who takes up in Lucretian verses the subject of magnets, in order to propose a method by which magnetic forces might be used to send messages, alphabetic letter by letter, across long distances. Castiglione as Claudian follows, describing a nightingale and a lyre player who engage in a rapidly escalating competition to see which can best replicate the other's song, until the poor bird drops dead from exhaustion. Strozzi as Ovid, like Bembo, chooses magnets as his subject, offering an ideological tale in which, once upon a time, the outraged earth punished avaricious miners burrowing deep into her belly by transforming them into globs of magnetic iron that continued to be attracted by the precious metals they sought in life. Pontano as Statius tells of two men, one German, the other Portuguese, whose planned duel in the city of Vienna is suddenly interrupted by the arrival of a military enemy at the city's walls. They quickly agree to forego the duel and to assail instead their shared enemy in a contest of glory. One loses his left arm in the fighting, the other his right, and so they fight side by side, to the death, one bearing a shield with his remaining arm, the other a sword. The last tale, by Navajero as Virgil, regards the rape of Tuatile, a French woman who, following the example of the biblical Judith, plunges a sword deep into the throat of her sleeping rapist. The contest isn't quite over yet, however. The archipoeta suddenly throws his hat into the ring with a versified account of an event recent enough to make his skill at speedy improvisation plain. Only the night before, a bolt of lightning had ignited fireworks installed for a spectacle in the Pope's honor at the summit of the Castel Sant'Angelo, or rather, the Hadriani Moles, since Querno's poem gives the castle the name it earns from the mausoleum of the Roman Emperor Hadrian that provides its structural base and core. All of this, as you can see, is quite a can of worms. I'm going to come at it from several directions. The first and last recitations frame the ensemble with a fairly straightforward kind of temporal dislocation. In the first, an ancient poet from Spain, Lucan, tells a tale of 13th century Spain to a modern audience, which is to say that he describes what are local but future events relative to himself to listeners for whom those same events already belong to a distant past, albeit that no man's time that will come to be called the Middle Ages. The last, likewise, has an ancient poet look forward to medieval events, though Tuatile herself looks back not to classical antiquity, but to the longer ago, farther away moral exemplar of the Old Testament. Querno's appendix, furthermore, gives us a similarly vertiginous stack of space-time, atop a monument of Renaissance Rome, sandwiched between the electrified cosmos above and the tomb of an ancient Roman below. But it is inside this frame that the mind truly begins to grow giddy in the face of prospects so Borgesian that I feel compelled to reassure you from the get-go that I am making none of it up. Strada's proposition, via Bembo as Lucretius, of magnetically transmitted messages attracted the almost immediate attention of early modern science. The specific suggestion was to magnetize two needles from the same magnet and then to mount them, like compass needles, at the center of two dials inscribed on their circumference with the letters of the alphabet. Move one needle to this or that letter, the theory went, and the other needle would follow suit, regardless of the distance between them. I've given you the descriptive passage of that poem on your handout. I'll just read the translation. That's number three. If, therefore, you need information from a friend who is far away and unreachable by letter, follow these instructions. Take a broad, flat disk and write out along its edge the letters of the alphabet in the order used by children when learning them. In the middle, flat against the disk, set a magnetized needle so that it can rotate to touch any letter you want. Along the same lines, make another disk inscribed with a similar border and furnished with a pointer made of iron endowed with motion by the same magnet. Let the friend who is departing carry this disk for himself after you have first agreed on the days and times when he should check to see whether the needle is vibrating or communicating anything by pointing. Having made these preparations, if you want to address secretly this friend whom the face of the earth keeps far from you, touch your hand to the disk and move the rotating iron. The idea, to be clear, was not entirely Strada's own. Versions of it had been circulating for years, beginning at least with the 1589 20-book edition of Gian Battista della Porta's Magia Naturalis, which Strada probably knew directly, though he could also have known of della Porta's proposition from the mention it receives in the Sympathia Septimatalorum of della Porta's friend Petrus Arlensis de Scaralupis, first published in Rome in 1610, but soon placed on the index, suppressed, opines a later chronicler, in order that its grand secrets might not become known, unquote. Nevertheless, Strada gave the proposition new notoriety. The 1629 Philosophia Magnetica of Strada's fellow Jesuit Niccolo Cabello includes an illustration of the proposed communicator, accompanied, however, by the author's disdainful rejection of the idea's plausibility. And Cabello's illustration is number four on your handout. A few years later, none other than Galileo Galilei had weighed in on the question, heaping similar scorn on the suggestion via one of the speakers in his 1632 Dialogo, and that's number five. You remind me of a man who wanted to sell me a secret of communication through the sympathy of magnetized needles, so that it would be possible to converse over a distance of 3,000 miles. I told him I would willingly purchase it, provided he would show me an experiment and that it would suffice if I remained in one room while he went in another. He replied that the distance was too short to exhibit the operation of the invention properly, so I dismissed him, saying that it was not convenient for me to travel just then to Cairo or Moscow to test the matter, but if he would go there himself, I would remain in Venice and do the rest. Needless to say, nothing about Strada's madcap prelusion would suggest he meant for his pseudoscientific propositions to be taken so seriously. Nevertheless, their skeptical reception was somewhat premature. Strada's device could never work as described, but this hardly stopped it from haunting scientific imaginations. The idea was again thrust into the public eye in 1711, when Joseph Addison discussed the poem on the pages of The Spectator. He later translated and paraphrased Strada's whole poetic contest for The Guardian, and I've given you Addison's account on your handout, but I won't read that. The first working electromagnetic telegraph was still a century off, but when it did come, in 1816, from English inventor Francis Ronalds, it included at either end a one-handed clock ringed by the letters of the alphabet. Looking back from the end of the 19th century, John Joseph Fahey, in A History of Electric Telegraphy to the Year 1837, published in 1884, gives Strada a significant nod, while Benjamin Park, in A History of Electricity from Antiquity to the Days of Benjamin Franklin, published in 1891, assigns him a key role in the long durée of electrical thinking itself. Bembo's dials, however, may not be the prelusion's only link to electrical thinking. The poem Strada places in the mouth of Pontano, dressed as Statius, tells the gruesome story of two mutilated soldiers, once rivals, now allies, who supply, in effect, one another's phantom limbs in order to fight as a single body. It's hard not to think of the armless Laocoon inspiring Sadoleto's Rome to fill in the gaps. but the tale may reveal another spectral influence on Strada's whole strange thought world, in the form of a rival telegraphic fantasy that circulated at the same time as, and sometimes alongside, that of sympathetic needles mounted on alphabetic dials. Philippus Aureolus Theophrastus Bombastus von Hockenheim, thankfully better known simply as Paracelsus, seems to have been the first to commit to print, in his De Secretis Naturae Mysteriis, the bizarre proposition of telegraphic communication via sympathetic flesh. If, the theory went, skin from one man were grafted onto the body of another, and once both healed, the respective spots were tattooed with the letters of the alphabet in the same arrangement, then a pin pressed against a letter on one would produce a sensation beneath the corresponding letter on the other, regardless of the distance that separated them. It's a disturbing idea, enough to make your flesh crawl, which is another way of saying it just might work. Just kidding. But it's easy to miss, among all the blood and gore, the remarkable link, if only by association and juxtaposition, that this story and that of the telegraphic dials makes between bodily sensation and electromagnetic transmission, even though Luigi Galvani and the discovery of what he would call animal electricity would not come until 1780. No less prescient is the poetic performance of Strozzi as Ovid, about the musical contest between the boy and the nightingale. In its description of the music they made, Strada's poem reaches out into the polyphonic soundscapes of contemporary Rome, home to a Roman school of music that embraces composers from Palestrina a bit before to Carissimi a bit after. The ancient sources underpinning Strada's nightingale would be very long to list. I've given you just a relevant bit of natural history from Pliny on your handout, but I won't read that. In calling the bird Philomela, rather than the more prosaic Luscinia, Castiglione as Claudian invokes, above all, Claudian's own favorite predecessor, namely Ovid, whose ideological myth of the nightingale is among the most violent of his metamorphoses. But intertexts could easily be multiplied. In the sonic realms of ancient poetry, the nightingale reigns supreme. Equally impressive, however, is the number of later productions for which Strada's poem is itself the source. A number of the Prelusion's poems were translated or reworked by other poets, but Strada's Nightingale, as William Cowper titles his own version, was the clear favorite. And it's on your handout, and I might as well quickly read it. The shepherd touched his reed, sweet Philomel assayed, and oft assayed to catch the strain. And treasuring as on her ear they fell, the numbers echoed note for note again. The peevish youth, who ne'er had found before a rival of his skill, indignant heard. And soon for various was his tuneful store, and loftier tones defied the simple bird. She dared the task, and rising as he rose, with all the force that passion gives inspired, returning the sounds a while, but in the close, exhausted fell, and at his feet expired. Thus strength, not skill, prevailed, O fatal strife, by thee, poor songstress, playfully begun, and O sad victory which cost thy life, and he may wish that he had never won. In all of these respects, the poem and its tradition embrace what I have elsewhere called the phonographic imaginary of classical and classicizing poetry, in its invocation of the all-imitating nightingale, in the multiplying sources and targets of the tradition to which such poetry belongs, in the poem's reach not just for music, but for a music that, via musical notation, has moved song just about as far as it can go from words, and finally, in the patterning of the poem's story, not so much on the myth of Tereus and Philomela, as on that of Narcissus and Echo. As a recording device, man's victory over female beast is a Pyrrhic one here, but both will bow 2.5 centuries later to yet another machine Strada seems to prefigure. And I mean, of course, Edison's phonograph. You are, I trust, catching my drift. There's something positively spooky about the way in which Strada's poetic follies seem to predict, as if by effortless afterthought, the telegraph, the phonograph, and the study of bioelectromagnetism, all punctuated by a rousing bolt of electricity in Quaerno's finale. But some of you will also have detected, in Strada's magnetic themes, a drift in the opposite direction, back all the way to Plato. This is the last item on your handout. I do see Ion, and in fact will proceed to show you what to my mind it betokens. As I just now have said, this gift you have of speaking well on Homer is not an art. It is a power divine, impelling you like the power in the stone Euripides calls the magnet, which most call the stone of Heraclea. This stone does not simply attract the iron rings just by themselves. It also imparts to the rings a force enabling them to do the same thing as the stone itself, that is, to attract another ring, so that sometimes a chain is formed, quite a long one, of iron rings, suspended from one another. For all of them, however, their power depends upon that lodestone. Just so the muse. She first makes men inspired, and then, through these inspired ones, others share in the enthusiasm, and a chain is formed. For the epic poets, all the good ones have their excellence not from art, but are inspired, possessed, and thus they utter all these admirable poems. In retrospect, it seems almost inevitable that Plato's famous simile of magnets would find its way into Strada's imagination, since the whole setup of the latter's mad story is one of authoritative influence. Bembo, Castiglione, and the rest move their audience by powers that properly do not belong to themselves, but that instead are derived from the ancient authors, whose vital forces they channel, and by whom, to use Plato's language, they are inspired, possessed. As Passanante puts it, likewise noting the connection to Plato's Ion, quote, "In having Bembo dress up as Lucretius and sing about magnets, Strada was not only using the ancient poet to explain the function of the iron interpreter, he was also using the device to describe the effects of Lucretius on his readers." And so, which is it? Are Strada's prelusions haunted not only by the spectral influence of classical poetry's gray eminences, including Lucretius, but also by Plato, the perennially undead manipulator of Western thought and metaphor? Or are they haunted instead by a technological future, dimly seen, barely materialized, but almost present all the same? Surely the right answer must be both. Plato's Ion and the ions of electromagnetism are links in the same chain. A bad joke that probably makes me sound like I'm rattling Charles Martindale's chain of reception, the figure by which he sought both to contest and reconfigure and redeploy the view of the classical tradition as a continuum. But there's a difference. Strada is not dutifully relaying messages from the ancient past. That, of course, is the view that reception theory rejected. But neither can he really be better understood as a creative or mischievous manipulator of these. On the contrary, the message decidedly is not the message here. The whole conversation, after all, is about style, not quod dicitur, but quo modo. And style, Strada, as Saruleto has told us, like language itself, is like a piece of clothing, which is what it is even without anybody in it. Clothes made the ghosts on that imagined day in haunted Rome. Or to put this another way, the medium was a medium, as poetry made dead poets address the present directly. But the most important ghost, the archifantasma, was the ghost in the machine, or rather the ghost as a machine, figured by the spectral machina of Mount Parnassus, floating through Rome and down the Tiber. From rhapsodes to telegraphs and phonographs, the West has never really stopped building machines that record and transmit. A persistent view adopted, as we have seen, by Strada, makes language itself into such a machine. So too, a fortiori, would song, writing, poetry be machines. Let us add tradition and reception, classical or otherwise. "Are you receiving me?" Martindale playfully asks, as the title of the brief section of Redeeming the Text, in which he asks his famous question about, quote, "meaning realized at the point of reception," unquote. But what if the point all along has not been messages sent or received, truly or falsely, but the whole machine to which this apparent meaning-making belongs? Let's face it, ghost stories are seldom really very much about what ghosts have to tell us. Their central subject is instead, and simply, contact with the dead, that is to say, the very possibility of haunting. And the same is true, I think, of our ghost machines, which already by Strada's day crisscrossed space and time like a pulsating electric grid. What matters about such machines is not what they purport to do, i.e. transmission, but what they model, which is not trans anything, but rather an influence free from the apparent limits of space and time. In other words, our machines are models of influence itself, pure and simple. It is here that the classical tradition's contact via Strada with early modern science may be the most striking. Isaac Newton was born 6 years before Strada's death, his Naturalis Philosophiae Principia Mathematica espousing his views on mechanics, universal gravitation, and planetary motion would appear in 1687. Tantalizingly, a copy of the 1662 Oxford edition of Strada's Prolusiones survives from Newton's library. Though it has long been in private hands, was sold at auction in New York by Sotheby's in 2015, and its current whereabouts are unknown to me. If any of you has it, let me know. On its flyleaf is written Isaac Newton in Newton's own hand, linking the two thinkers' names while marking the site of an intellectual influence that, from our own third perspective, seems to pull equally on the thought of both men across both space and time. But more to the point, might Newton himself have detected invisible forces at work not just in the real world of falling apples, but in the fictive one of Strada's spectral influences, and more broadly, in the whole mad enterprise that has been the classical tradition? Of course, if I may make a bit of a Newtonian joke, once one starts down this slippery slope, there's no good way to stop. In other words, if Strada can be said to anticipate Newton, then his confounding of space-time can just as easily be said to anticipate Newton's undoing by Einstein. My purpose, in any case, emphatically is not to find any new single points of origin for anything, from telegraphs to phonographs to physics, Newtonian or otherwise. Rather, my purpose has been to show how a close look at the classical tradition, with a critical eye to the principles of classical reception theory, winds up raising some rather extraordinary questions about epistemic transfer. Martindale and his successors have something crucial in common with predecessors who believed, and a few lingering contemporaries who still believe, that Greece and Rome were the ultimate sources of much that is valuable and meaningful in quote-unquote Western culture. For what all of them share is an assumption that meaning and value are to be sought at one or more particular points in the story they unfold, whether points of origin, points of reception, or even both, as some recent advocates of a return to the language of tradition have suggested. Strada instead tells a different story. His tale, tall as it is nevertheless meant, I would suggest, to function as a miniaturized version of the whole classical tradition, not entirely unlike early modern attempts to produce mechanized models of the cosmos. And in Strada, in miniature, we can see how that tradition does not merely move knowledge around. Rather, it embodies knowledge in the very possibilities of its structure. My suggestion, in other words, is that telegraphy, phonography, force, and doubtless many other ideas can best be understood not as the inventions of any particular time or place, but as abstractions from the very system that linked Newton to Strada to Bembo to Lucretius to Epicurus, and Edison to Cowper to Strada to Ovid, and so on. When did that system begin to take shape? Arguably, it did so no sooner than the ancients began to relate one myth or song or text to another. The persistence of their mythography, their music, their poetry, therefore, represents nothing less than the continued elaboration of an ever more complex model of relationality itself. To embrace such a view, I think, is to transform our understanding of how traditions, including but presumably not limited to the classical tradition, really work, and to discover a mostly overlooked set of purposes that they serve. And let me finally close by suggesting that this same embrace, going forward, could once again electrify the relationship between science and art. Thank you.